So I'll get going. So far I've gone over the reasons why you think that why we think there's dark matter, and I've gone over the ways in which or some of the most popular ways in which you can produce dark matter, and I've told you a little bit about specific WIMP candidates for WIMP dark matter. The next thing I want to move on to are ways to look for dark matter and hopefully discover dark matter through interactions that aren't gravity. So there are three main ways to do this. The first is looking for dark matter, looking for the dark matter all around us in lab experiments. The second way is to look for dark matter in our galactic halo, annihilating. And the third way is to try to produce dark matter directly in colliders. So I'm going to start off with so-called direct detection. Dark matter. And the direct part of direct detection just means finding dark matter in the lab. So the main idea behind direct detection is that we're sitting in a soup of dark matter particles, and we take a nucleus, we take a target, which in this case is going to be an atomic nucleus. So I'll call the nucleus N, and it has a atomic number Z, and atomic number A and charge Z, and you look for a dark matter particle chi to come in, and the dark matter particle chi is going to scatter off, and your nucleus is going to recoil with some momentum Q and some recoil energy ER. And the idea of direct detection is you get a lot of nuclei. You put them essentially in a very shielded box, and you look for your nuclei in the box to recoil for no good reason. So this whole process, you never actually see the dark matter particle come in, you never actually see it go out, you just see your nucleus recoiling away. And this dark matter direct detection is a little bit analogous to looking for neutrinos. In neutrino detectors, you don't see the neutrino coming in, you don't see the neutrino coming out, you just see the effect of the neutrino hitting something. So that's what we're going to do here. And to set up the discussion, I want to remind you first of what we think the dark matter around us, or how the dark matter around us is distributed. So I spoke a little bit about this earlier, but here's a cartoon of our galaxy. The cartoon of our galaxy is that the stars in our galaxy are basically all in a very flat disk. And in the middle of the disk, there's a place where it's not so flat, where there's sort of a galactic bulge. So the stars in our galaxy are distributed either in a very flat disk or in a central bulge in the middle. And relative to this disk, which has a radius, at least in the visible part, of roughly 20 kiloparsecs, our sun is located somewhere around here. And our sun is a distance of about 9 kiloparsecs from the center of the galaxy. And this whole galactic disk is rotating around. So that's the first thing. Now, we expect that there's just about around every galaxy, there's a big halo of dark matter. So we think that there's a roughly spherical, I haven't drawn this too well, but we think there's a roughly spherical halo of dark matter surrounding and encompassing the visible stuff in the galaxy. And this dark matter halo has a density that's largest near the middle and falls off as you go further out. So this is kind of the 3D view. The side view is we have a flat galactic disk. There's a galactic bulge. We're somewhere over here. And then surrounding this whole thing is a big dark matter halo. So this is our side view. So there are two quantities we need to know, or I'll say three things that we need to know about this structure of our galaxy plus the dark matter halo around it. The first thing we need to know is local dark matter density. And we think the local dark matter density is roughly 0.3 plus or minus 0.1 GeV per cubic centimeter. So for example, if we have a WIMP dark matter particle with a mass of about 100 GeV, this works out to roughly one dark matter particle per teacup, just to give you an idea. And these dark matter particles are whizzing around us all the time. So this is the first quantity we need. The second quantity we need is the distribution of dark matter velocities within the halo. And that distribution of dark matter velocities in the halo, we don't quite know exactly what it is. But we've done simulations of dark matter dynamics. And we can also measure rotation curves of other galaxies and look at what we expect our velocity distributions there. And what we expect is that our F of V should look roughly something like a Gaussian. So I'll write this Gaussian as 1 over pi V naught squared, the 3/2. Actually, sorry. It'll be a distribution in the vector quantity of velocity. And the normalization is 1 is integral d3V F of V. So this is roughly just a Maxwellian distribution. But there's one slight little catch. And that one slight little catch is that if I have a dark matter velocity that's too big, that dark matter can escape the gravitational potential of this dark matter halo. So to correct for that, I'm going to take this Maxwellian and I'm going to multiply it by a cutoff. So the cutoff is going to be, it's just a theta function. So in other words, if the magnitude of my velocity is less than the escape velocity, this is 1. And if it's greater than the escape velocity, I get 0. And one last thing is I need to multiply this by a normalization factor that I'll call n escape, just to account for the fact that instead of just having a Gaussian, or instead of just having a Gaussian, which is already property normalized with respect to this, this theta function cuts off the Gaussian, so the normalization changes a little bit. So this normalization is just some error, just some sort of error functions, but it's actually pretty close to 1. So having said this, the parameters that go into this are V0. Our V0 is roughly 230 kilometers per second. And in units of C, this is roughly 10 to the minus 3. So the dark matter in our halo is going fast, but it's still basically non-relativistic. The other thing is our escape velocity. Again, we're not quite certain what it is exactly, but it seems to be, given the motion of our galaxy, roughly 600 kilometers per second. So this escape velocity correction is actually just a small correction on the distribution, because it only cuts things off pretty far out of a tail. So this is the velocity distribution of dark matter in this big halo. But on top of this, we're also moving with respect to the halo. So we're sitting here, and we're rotating around the sun. And the sun is rotating along with the galactic disk rotating around. And there's some rotation velocity for that. And then on top of that, there's an additional velocity for the fact that we're also orbiting around the sun. So we also have a net velocity. I'll write it this way. The velocity of the Earth with respect to the halo is roughly the velocity of the sun plus an extra velocity due to the rotation of the Earth around the sun. Where this V0 is roughly 220 kilometers per second.
So E stands for Earth?
Yeah, E stands for the Earth. And I guess I'm not being quite consistent. The dot with the circle around it stands for the sun. I'm writing E for Earth, but I guess sometimes you also see this for the Earth, and that's stands for the Sun. But somehow in the dark matter literature, people use this for the Sun, which is a standard astronomy thing. But instead of using the standard astronomy thing for the Earth, they just use E. So there's no good reason for this. It's just so bullet points just to separate it out. And as far as this oscillation goes, obviously the period for the oscillation corresponding to one of is 1 year. I mean that we go around the Sun once every 1 year, and it turns out that the maximum the phase is such that we're going along with the rotation of the Sun around the center of the galaxy when T0 is equal to June 2nd. So if you're looking for another holiday to celebrate, another special day to celebrate on June 2nd, you can celebrate maximal alignment with the galactic rotation day. So it's actually a little bit before the summer solstice, June 21st. But okay. In any case, starting from here, you can use this information to get an idea of what this kind of scattering is going to look like. So first of all, this energy density means that the number density is just going to be the energy density divided by the dark matter mass, because the dark matter is non-relativistic. And this velocity distribution, comparing this and this, means that the typical dark matter velocity is going to have some spread, but it's going to be roughly on the order of 10 to the minus 3. So the very first thing we should do, just to get an idea of what the scattering is going to look like, is just check the kinematics. And this is very straightforward, but it's still good to work out. So the idea of the kinematics is that I've got my dark matter particle impinging on a nucleus, and the nucleus is basically a rest, so we'll treat it as rest. And the dark matter is coming in with some velocity v. And this is before the collision, and then after the collision, you have your dark matter going out, and you also have your nucleus recoiling, and the nucleus is recoiling with, again, some momentum q and some energy er. And first of all, we're going to assume our dark matter is not super, super heavy. And in that case, because the dark matter velocity is about 10 to the minus 3, this is just a non-relativistic scattering. So putting everything in and assuming it's non-relativistic, what you find is that the momentum transferred to the nucleus is just 2 mu cos theta, where theta is the angle relative to the incoming dark matter direction. And this mu n is the dark matter nucleus reduced mass. So it's just m chi times mn divided by m chi plus mn. So if I have a dark matter particle with mass of about 100 GeV, and I'm scattering off a heavy nucleus with roughly the same mass, and my velocity is 10 to the minus 3, this ends up coming out to be roughly 100 MeV. So that's my momentum transfer. And the other thing I can check is the recoil energy. And the recoil energy, because it's non-relativistic, is just q squared over 2 mn. And under the same assumptions for the recoil energy, I get about 100 keV. So these are pretty low energy recoils. But fortunately, it turns out that realistic detectors are sensitive to this range of energies of nuclear recoils. Yeah.
So what was n again?
Oh, sorry.
That's v, right?
N is a nucleus. This is the velocity.
Yes, right. I thought it was an n.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah. But in any case, I can look for this energy of nuclear recoils. And let me also mention that the reason we use atomic nuclei instead of electrons is that if I run the same numbers for electrons, the reduced mass for an electron, assuming my dark matter has a mass of about 100 GeV, motivated by this Wundt miracle, I would get a much smaller momentum transfer, and I would get a really, really tiny sort of order millielectron volt recoil energies. And it turns out that those very low energy electron recoils are very difficult to see in the lab. So as a practical matter, at least in the case where dark matter is relatively heavy, the thing we want to look for, is recoiling nuclei and not recoiling electrons. Okay, so once we set this up, we can go off and look at and try to estimate the total rate for dark matter scattering in a detector. And we make use of this information, but that getting this rate is a very straightforward thing to do. So the thing we actually do to compare with experiment is we look at the quantity DER, and by this I mean the differential rate of nuclear recoils. How do I want to normalize it? Per unit detector mass. So it's very, well, converting this into particle physics quantities is pretty straightforward, because this quantity is essentially just the number of nuclear targets per unit mass times the cross-section, or the differential cross-section to scatter, for a dark matter particle to scatter off a nucleus. And I then have to multiply by the total dark matter flux. So taking into account the quantities I mentioned above for the distribution of dark matter in our galaxy, what this reduces to, writing everything out explicitly, is going to be the number density of targets, so the density of targets per unit mass, and the number of targets per unit mass. The dark matter flux itself is going to be the local density, the local number density of dark matter times the dark matter velocity. So the number density of dark matter is just the energy density divided by the mass, because it's non-relativistic. Yes?
What is the number of targets per unit mass? I mean, I can understand number of targets per unit volume, but yeah.
I guess I didn't explain this. This d sigma n der,
right,
is the differential cross section to scatter off a single nucleus,
right,
of type n.
Yeah.
But in my detector, I of course have lots of nuclei, and I'm going to have some event. I'll have some total event rate for my detector. And that total event rate is just this quantity times the total number of nuclei.
Right.
And I just divide that quantity by the total detector mass.
Right.
So it's the rate per kilogram of detector material. Okay, so for the flux, we have to take into account that instead of having just a single dark matter velocity, we have lots. So that just amounts to integrating d3v f of v times v times d sigma n der. So in writing this, I've left a little space. And the reason why I've left a little space is that the distribution we use here is not quite exactly that distribution up there. So the distribution I wrote up there is a distribution of dark matter velocities relative to the galactic halo. And the galactic halo, we expect, is basically just sitting at rest. But the thing is that us being the sun and the Earth going around it, is rotating around in the galactic disk within the halo. So we have some additional motion relative we have some additional motion relative to the halo, so the velocity distribution that we see is a bit modified compared to that. So the thing that goes in here is, in fact, the lab frame, in other words, our frame, and it's going to be a function of both the dark matter velocity and the Earth velocity. And in this case, this quantity is not the dark matter velocity relative to the halo, but the dark matter velocity relative to us. So this V is V halo plus V Earth. So what we can do to get this distribution is use the fact that we know that this distribution, you rewrite it in terms of V minus V Earth. OK, but once I have that, this is the whole formula for dark matter direct detection. And it has, well, it has multiple pieces. This is just a detector bit. And if you're doing an experiment, you better know this. So that's under control. This piece is particle physics. And that's up to us to compute as particle physics. But there's also some astrophysics. And the astrophysics is contained in the dark matter flux, in the sense that we have this velocity distribution of dark matter in the halo around us, and we have this local dark matter density. So we think we have a pretty good idea of what these are. And I've written down above what we think that pretty good idea is. But we don't know these things exactly. So at this point, because we're just trying to find dark matter, it makes sense to use a reasonable guess for this astrophysics stuff and to try to detect the new particle. But in principle, down the road, if we start to see a lot of dark matter particle scattering, and if we're able to really probe and understand the dark matter particle, we can actually use dark matter as a way to study astrophysics. In the sense that if we really know this piece, we measure this, and we use it to get that. So my own interest is in terms of finding new particles, but down the road, this could actually be a very useful tool for astrophysics. OK, so in any case, though, the piece that's left for us to compute is this d sigma der. And our typical, so I'll assume that our target consists of a single nucleus that I'll write this way. It has some atomic number of z and some charge a and some charge z. In general, the targets people use in experiments contain multiple nuclei. And if you have multiple nuclei, you just sum the result for a single nucleus over all the individual contributions to it. Now, the tricky part, though, is we're going to have to face both elementary particle physics together with hadronic physics and nuclear physics. And the reason for that is that what we start with in our underlying theory is couplings of the dark matter particle to quarks, or the dark matter particle to gluons. But these quarks and gluons combine within nucleons. So neutrons are protons. And of course, nucleons combine to make the nucleus. So the process that we're going to follow is that we'll start off with the elementary interactions in terms of these underlying fundamental fields. And we'll go from here in the first step to connect the scattering with the fundamental fields with scattering off nucleons. And the second step is to connect the scattering with nucleons to the scattering with nuclei. So this step is typically under pretty control. This step is a bit iffier, but we have some reasonable parameterizations to handle it. Okay, so for the first part, where do I want to start? For the first part, we should look at dark matter quark operators and dark matter gluon operators. And of course, these operators should be gauge invariant. So the kinds of operators we can write down are chi bar chi, Q bar Q, chi bar gamma mu chi, Q bar gamma mu Q, chi bar chi, G mu nu A, G mu nu A, plus other operators, as well as chi bar gamma 5, chi, q bar, gamma 5, q, chi bar, gamma mu, gamma 5, chi, q bar, gamma mu, gamma 5, q, and on and on. So these are some of the operators I can write down. And two comments. The first is that I've written these as just fermion operators or quark operators. So for the time being, I'm assuming that dark matter is a fermion, but I could write down similar operators if dark matter was a scalar. But the first comment is that in general, in the underlying theory, you don't start with this kind of operator. You start with an operator. You start with couplings between, let's say, the dark matter and a gauge boson, or dark matter and a Higgs. And those Higgs or gauge bosons also couple to quarks. So for example, when I write down this, what I actually have in mind is a Feynman diagram that looks like that. So for this first operator, I have in mind this Feynman diagram, where this intermediate state is something, is some kind of Higgs, or some kind of scalar particle. And if I think about the propagator for this, because the dark matter scattering here is very low energy, the propagator for this is going to be 1 over q squared minus mh squared. But our q squared is very small. And because this q squared is very small, at least compared to most particle physics scales, this is going to be equal to roughly 1 over mh squared. And in this limit, where I can ignore the momentum going through the propagator, where the propagator is just dominated by the mass, this diagram reduces to a diagram where I just have a point interaction. So in writing this thing, I actually have in mind this, where the intermediate mediator is very heavy. And because of that, this interaction reduces to a four fermion point interaction, which is what I've written down here. And in the same way, this operator could arise from exchanging a vector. So that's comment number one. My second comment is that I don't know why I'm writing out comment number one and comment number two, but the second thing I wanted to say is that I've also split this into two lines. And the stuff in the first line, I've put there for a specific reason. And that is, the stuff in the first line, when I couple this to, when I take these quark operators and I combine them into nucleons and then combine the nucleons into nuclei, for the line one, the result is that the stuff couples roughly just to the number of nucleons. And the stuff in the line two, when I combine the quark operators into nucleon operators and nuclei operators, the stuff couples to the spin of the nucleons that make up the nucleus. So for this reason, the kind of operators I've written down here that don't depend specifically on spin, that just depend on, that more or less count nucleons, these are called spin independent. Or SI for short. And the bottom ones are called spin dependent operators, or they lead to something called what we call spin dependent scattering, where the scattering depends on the spin of the nucleus you're scattering off. And this is usually abbreviated as SD. The other thing is the structure of these operators. A gamma bar gamma is called a scalar. And this combination transforms under parity and Lorentz like a Lorentz scalar. This quantity, so we call this operator scalar. If I look at this combination, this chi bar gamma 5 chi, this operator transforms like a pseudoscalar under Lorentz imparity. So we call this combination P, this combination P. This combination, not surprisingly, transforms like a vector. This combination transforms like a vector. And this is a scalar, and this piece transforms like a scalar. This piece, however, transforms like an axial vector. So a vector that doesn't get a sign change under parity, and similarly here. So the stuff I've written down for spin independent corresponds to VV, scalar. The stuff I've written down for spin dependent is axial, or pseudoscalar. And of course, I have to contract all my Lorentz indices. And you might be wondering, however, why no scalar, pseudoscalar, or VA, or mixed combinations? And the reason for that is, I'll have you work this out in a specific example, is that in the scalar, or vector, or axial, or pseudoscalar, when I compute the cross-sections for these at leading order in the velocity expansion are proportional to zero powers of the incoming dark matter velocity. On the other hand, these combinations, these so-called mixed combinations, give me cross sections that are proportional to v squared. And remember, v is the velocity of the incoming dark matter particle. And this gives me a suppression of 10 to the minus 6. So typically, if my theory contains this kind of operator, even if it also contains this kind of operator, the combination, the contributions from these operators to the scattering are suppressed a whole lot relative to the VV or SS or AA or PP. There are a few special cases where these operators can be important. For example, when these kind of the usual operators we consider are very suppressed for one reason or another. But for the most part, people just ignore this kind of operator. Because in most cases, it's much, much more suppressed than these standard spin-independent or spin-dependent. Okay. Okay, so the next step is I'm going to start off talking about the spin-independent case. So I'll start off with the scalar-scalar case and show you how you go from particle physics to, or LN2 particles to nucleons to nuclei. So we'll look at the scalar-scalar operator. And of course, this will be so-called spin-independent scattering. So my starting point for this, how do I write this? My starting point for this is I'm going to assume that my effective Lagrangian describes a theory. My effective Lagrangian contains the couplings dq, chi bar chi, q bar q. And this q, this Q is going to involve both the heavy quarks and the light quarks. So I'm going to refer to these collectively. Sorry for the confusion. I'm going to refer to the light quarks collectively with a little q and the heavy quarks collectively with a big q, because they're going to behave a little bit differently. The other thing is that if I do power counting on this dq, the mass dimension of dq is going to be 1 over mass squared. So the mass dimension is minus 2. And given, for example, the dq is going to be some combination. If it comes from a diagram like this, it's going to be some combination of a coupling here and a coupling here, plus 1 over the mass of the mediator squared. So that gives you the mass dimension minus 2. OK, so given this interaction, it's very, very straightforward to compute the scattering, the elastic scattering of a chi with a quark, treating the quark as some heavy object at rest. What I want to convert this into, however, at the first stage, is into a scattering of a single nucleon. So to convert this quark operator into the scattering of a single nucleon, what I do what I need is a matrix element of this operator between an initial state nucleon and a final state nucleon. So this piece doesn't care about the nucleon in the initial final state, but the q bar q does. So what I need to compute for a given nucleon is I'll start off with the light quarks, and by n tilde I mean either proton or neutron. So it turns out that this quantity is, it's hard to compute analytically, but people simulate QCD on a space-time lattice, so-called lattice QCD, and they extract this matrix element from that. And the way they write the result is, it's just going to be a number because this thing is just a Lorentz scalar. It's going to be the mass of the nucleon times a quantity called FTQ. Of a nucleon. And this applies specifically for the light quarks. And we extract these values using lattice QCD. And the net result for these Fs is that the net result is that the strange quark piece is basically equivalent to, for the neutron, is roughly equal to the strange quark piece for the proton. And this is much, much bigger than everything for the light nucleons for the up and down quarks. So the dominant piece from light quarks comes from the strange quark, typically. So that's the first thing. The second thing we need, however, is the contribution from heavy quarks. So for heavy quarks, we do the same thing. We write MQ Q bar Q. But the thing is, in a theory with nucleons, my typical energy scale is going to be around a GeV. Because if I start probing my nucleons at energies much, much above a GeV, they're going to break into quarks, or I'm going to probe their underlying quark structure. So this thing, it turns out that the proper way to handle this is to effectively integrate out these heavy quarks and get an effective operator. So what this means in this case is that if I look at nucleons, there's really not much of a direct matrix element with heavy quarks in the nucleon. But on the other hand, there is a loop contribution. And that loop contribution comes from, the loop contribution comes from the fact that I can take my heavy quarks. So here's my operator. I can take my heavy quarks, let's say a top quark or a bottom quark or a charm quark, and I can close up a loop of them, of the heavy quark. And I can couple this loop to gluons. So instead of computing this direct thing at one loop order, this thing it actually turns into a gluon operator. So this thing should actually be transferred into an effective matrix element of, there's a number from the loop factor, turns out to be minus 2 alpha s over 24 pi times g mu nu a, g a mu nu. And this contribution, it turns out, is, yep.
What is the horizontal line?
Oh, sorry. So I start with a q bar q operator. Sorry. So I start with this operator, but let's say a top quark here. So this operator with a top quark is going to have a dark matter in, dark matter out. And let's say it's the top quark. I take the top quark loop, close it off, attach it to gluons, and this piece goes to that piece. And this is the effect of, in the low energy effective theory, of integrating out the heavy quark. So if I integrate out the heavy quark at tree level, I get nothing. But if I integrate out the heavy quark at one loop, so in other words, I write down a low energy theory without the heavy quark, but where I write down all the possible operators and include the effects of the heavy quark, I get this operator generated. So this piece gives me something like this. And this combination, it turns out we define it to be, this is going to look a little bit funny, but it'll make sense in a second, minus 2 alpha s over 24 pi times minus 8 pi over 9 alpha s. Okay, so all I've done here is I've taken this matrix element and I've defined, I've renamed this, the result of this matrix element, which is just a number according to this quantity FTG.
Are those the parton distribution functions or something related to
those? They're related to parton distribution functions. So this quantity is basically the gluon density in a nucleon. In the same way that this quantity is roughly the quark density in the nucleon. It's not quite the density though. The density would actually have a gamma zero in here. But specifically, it's just the expectation value of this matrix element. The expectation value of this operator sandwiched between two nucleons. And this is exactly the thing you could compute in the lattice. But it is related to the quark density.
So I did not completely understand how we read this amplitude. We have MAQQ as operator who mediates the external states, and but I mean, we have we get external gluons, and how do we couple those to our external states?
Oh well, so you're happy with this step though. So are you happy with this step?
Yeah.
Where so I go from here, and the effect of the heavy quarks is to run in a loop and to produce a gluon.
And the tree level amplitude is negligible because of the mass.
Yeah. So if I think of if I think about a nucleon, talking about a nucleon only really makes sense for energies not too much bigger than a GeV. If I have energies a lot bigger than a GeV, let's say in some kind of center mass frame, my nucleon is just going to look like a bunch of quarks or gluons. So the proper way to handle heavy particles in a theory that's only really sensible at low energies is to integrate them out. And what I mean by integrate them out is that I start with a high energy theory with heavy particles, and to drive an effective theory for the low energy case, I take those heavy particles and I find their interactions they induce among the light states, and I write down a theory without the heavy particles where I put in the new operators corresponding to the contributions of the heavy particles between the interactions of the light states. So that's what I've done here. In this case, if I think about nucleons, a nucleon basically doesn't contain any charm quark or top quark or bottom quark. But it does contain a lot of up quark and down quark and strange quark directly. So it contains them in the sense that a proton has a quantum numbers of up, up, down. But a proton also has a lot of gluons running around. And it also has a lot of light quark, anti-quark pairs. So a proton isn't just UDD. It has the net quantum numbers of UDD, but it has also all these extra quark anti-quark pairs for the light quarks and a lot of gluon stuff floating around. So what this combination does, what this glue measures in a sense, is how much glue stuff you have within the nucleon. And the number we assign to that is this FTG with some slightly funny normalization.
Okay. So we do not really calculate how the gluons then couple to external states. When we write that out, we just say we have a measure for that.
In a sense, yeah. So suppose my starting point was a coupling chi bar chi glu. Now, gluons couple to nucleons. And as a result of that, this matrix element is non-zero. So, or put another way, if I start with the fundamental interaction chi bar chi, glu, that interaction is going to mediate the chi scattering with the nucleon. Because the nucleon contains some gluon,
it's
that gluon. And this is the prescription. It's very non-trivial to get. We don't know how to compute it analytically. We have to simulate it on the lattice. But this is the conversion between the gluon operator and the scattering you would compute for starting with this gluon operator and computing the scattering it induces for the particle with the nucleon.
Okay. So we basically, in MF, it's included how some complicated lattice-QCD calculations do.
Yeah, but at the heart of it, what we're doing is, I mean, practice is very complicated, but what we're doing in principle is simple. We're starting with some operator written in terms of quarks or gluons. And the question is, if I start with that operator, how big of a scattering does it induce off a nucleon?
How
much scattering does it induce off a nucleon?
Yeah.
So the answer for the Q bar Q operator is this, which I parameterize in terms of these FTs. And the answer for glu is this FTG, which I parameterize that way. And actually driving this is very hard. You have to do a lot of fancy lattice stuff. But at the heart of it, it's just answering the question, if I start with this chi bar chi glu operator, how much does that scattering induce, how much scattering does it induce at the end of the day? But this is sort of the tricky part of the whole story, because there's a lot of stuff going on, in some sense, under the hood that we're just pulling out of Lattice QCD. It's hard to understand in an analytic sense. So let me just mention that this reduces to 2/27. And the reason for this funny normalization is that it turns out that by matching the theory of nucleons onto the theory of quarks, you can show that there's actually a relation between this FTG defined in this funny way and the other ones. Turns out this FTG is just 1 minus the sum of the light quarks. So it turns out that these relations, or these operators, are related to each other in a slightly non-trivial sense, and that this FTG can also be written in terms of the quark values. So in any case, the only things we need to compute are the three lattice quantities, FTS, and FTU, and FTD. But for the most part, these UD parts are very small, and this stuff is dominated by the strange quark bit. And then, of course, the heavy quarks are going to contribute a piece that goes like effectively a gluon operator with a 2/27 normalization. So when I take this stuff and I put it all together, what I find for my total cross-section, and I can express the total cross-section, where do I want to write this? I guess I'll just write it here. At the end of the day, we can rewrite the result as an effective interaction between the dark matter, and instead of starting with quarks, I can convert this into a dark matter nucleon interaction with some strength Fn tilde. So the idea is that we start with this simple elementary quark operator, where I talk about how the dark matter couples to quarks or gluons, as the case may be. And what I get out at the end of the day is a coupling of dark matter to nucleons, where I treat these nucleons as fundamental fields. So if I'm allowed to treat the nucleons as fundamental fields, I can just compute scattering in the usual way, just all the usual perturbative stuff. I don't have to worry about these funny matrix elements that come up. And I know how to work with this. So all the information that was put into here is encompassed in these couplings, Fn for F equals P and T. And what we find at the end of the day is that, I'll write it for the proton case. The result is that Fp over Mp is going to be, it's not hard to see how this comes out from here. It's going to be the sum over light quarks, sum over UDS of FTQP over, let me get the MQ times DQ plus 2/27 sum over Q CTV of, let's get this right, of DQ over MQ times FTG proton. So to get from here to here, all I've done is remember the overall coupling in the initial operator was DQ for each quark. And each quark contributes to this matrix element in this way by an amount of the nucleon mass times the corresponding FTQ. And I should actually divide off by the quark mass underlying everything. So that's why I get this combination FTQ over MQ DQ here. And then the other contribution from the heavy quarks comes from the fact that each one has a relative strength dq over mq. And I have this ftg. And I have to sum everything up. And one more comment I want to make about this whole story. Is that this FTG, this gluon piece, is basically the same for protons and neutrons. So in other words, the gluon content of a proton is basically the same as the gluon content for a neutron. So this piece is the same for both protons and neutrons. And this piece, it turns out, is basically almost entirely dominated by the strange quark bit. So for the strange quark bit, in most cases, assuming fairly similar DQs, the strange quark part contributes primarily here. And the upshot of that is that that means that the effective coupling I get to protons is basically the same as the effective coupling to neutrons under these sort of fairly broad assumptions. So we have these relative coupling strengths of protons and neutrons, and they turn out, in most cases, to be about the same. And like I said, I'm running out of time, so I think I should pack it up there. But what this is going to mean at the end of the day for the scalar-scalar operator for spin-independent scattering is that, at least for low-energy scatterings, the scattering is going to scatter coherently off all the nucleons within the nucleus. And for example, for a nucleus with atomic number A, I'm going to get an A squared enhancement of the effective coupling, because I'm going to scatter coherently off the whole thing. So I'll tell you the rest of the story in the next class tomorrow. But this is, we've gotten at least to the nucleon part. So we've gotten from elementary quarks and gluons to nucleons. And our next step is going to be to go from nucleons to nuclei, which is slightly a bit more fuzzy, but we have straightforward ways of parameterizing it.